The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
All right, good evening, everybody. This is Douglas B. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution, Mr. Constitution Hour here on Cape Race. Good to have you here with the program. And we left off last time at the beginning of Article 4 of the Constitution. But before I get into that, I want to remind the listeners that it is important as Christians for us to be involved. And in fact, the Bible demands it. We're not supposed to just hide in the corner, hide in the four walls of the church, and not be in the public square and doing something. Not only because of, you know, politically supporting a godly government and godly system is important, but also because that's a part of us professing our faith. The idea that we're supposed to share the scripture, share the good news of Christ, doesn't happen if we're not in the public square. We need to look no further than the book of James, and I found some verses for you to help you understand what the book of James has to say in the New Testament. So James chapter 1, verse 5, James 1, 5. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and unbraideth not, and it shall be given him. James 1:22. But be ye doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. Be ye doers of the word, but not hearers only. James 1:23-25. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass. James 2:14. What doeth it profit, my brethren, though a man say he hath faith and not have not worth? Can faith save him? James 2:18. Yea, a man may say, thou hast faith and have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by my works. James 2:26. For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. And finally, James 4:17. Therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, for him it is sin. Then we can go all the way back to Titus chapter 1, verse 16. They profess that they know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work reprobate. And then we can run over to 1 Peter 1:13. Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto thee at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And then we can go to 1 John 3:18. My little children, let us not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. So all of these verses are telling us that, you know, your mouth is not enough. We need to be in action. Our faith needs to have fruit follow it. Our fruit, we are judged by our fruit, are we not? And so, anyway, I wanted to open up with that. I thought it was important as Christians for us to hear that. So when we go through the Constitution here, and I talk about all of this stuff, it's important for you to understand that I don't want you just to be informed. I want you to do something with it. And why is it important for you to be informed about the Constitution and what is actually the truth and all that? You know, it's funny because nomination of Judge Jackson, the confirmation hearing is going on in the Senate right now, and she said something the other day about judicial law or law by the judges, something of those that nature, and I didn't catch it. It was caught actually by a student of mine from my class in Carlsbad. I'm sorry, my class in Fallbrook. And the woman says to me, you know, Doug, when I heard her say that, immediately I went, no, law comes from the legislature. Judges don't make law. They can't legislate. That is, you know, separation of powers. That only belongs to the legislative branch, the Congress. She says, Doug, a year ago, before I knew you, before I took class, I wouldn't have caught that. Now, she's able to better argue her point, better able to pinpoint, you know, that, well, this particular candidate's not good, and so she doesn't want the support behind this person because she's recognized that they don't understand the Constitution or they don't care about it, and it's... There's all kinds of ideas there, dynamic, that we can talk about some other time. But that's why it's important. When you're informed, when you understand, then you can better argue your point. You can better stand behind the people that you want to stand behind. You understand where they, what they believe and what they understand. Because you can pick up on those things. And so it's all important. So anyway, enough of that. Let's get to work here. But I thought that was important also to bring up. So Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution... And by the way, if you go to douglasvgibbs.com and find the Constitution classes link, there is a place where you can download all of my handouts for classes. And so you can read about what I've written, or you can buy the book, The Basic Constitution. Go to douglasvgibbs.com/store for that. I've got some orders I need to fulfill. Matter of fact, just recently some folks have been buying books, and I've got only a couple t-shirts left. Anyway, so if you want more information, you want to be able to read this stuff, it's available. I've written 8 books, and The Basic Constitution is the handouts in a book form. Okay, so Article 4. Hopefully you have your pocket constitutions or your book with your constitution in it out, or you have the constitution on your screen. And Article 4 begins in Section 1, full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. What that means is that now that the states are not their own little countries anymore, they've come together in a union. What happens in one state needs to be recognized in all the other states. So in other words, for example, you know, you have a driver's license for whatever state that you are from or you reside in. And when you go driving across the country, and let's say like me, you're in Southern California and you drive into Arizona, you don't have to pull into the DMV and get an Arizona license in order to drive through Arizona. Your California license is recognized by all the states, full faith and credit. Now, if you move there, they're going to want you to get a local license, and they're going to have their own testing system and all that. But as you move through the country, full faith and credit follows you. Your license is fine. Or let's say you have a record or an act or something like that, you know, your marriage record, for example. You don't have to get married again when you move to a different state with your spouse. Your marriage is recognized in all the states. So anyway, in judicial proceedings, you know, you were found guilty or not found guilty of something, guess what? That record's going to be available in other states as well. And if you remember in Article 1, Section 8, bankruptcies even follow you around. So full faith and credit, now we are a country. These states that used to be separate from each other, they used to be so sovereign that they weren't even a part of a union, now have come together in a union. So as a country, they have to recognize full faith and credit, that these things are not just only good in a state and one particular state, but that goes countrywide throughout the union. Okay, so now that all said, then why is it that other states don't recognize the gun permits from certain states? Should not the reciprocity, the full faith and credit, apply to, you know, the concealed carry permits as well, right? I mean, if I got a concealed carry permit from one state and I'm traveling around, should that not be recognized based on Article 4, full faith and credit? Should that be recognized in every state I go into? Of course, then again, when we get to the Second Amendment, we'll talk about how your right to keep and bear arms shouldn't even have a permit requirement. That's the reason why I love the constitutional carry laws that are emerging in a number of states. You can look it up. It's over 20 states now where you can conceal carry without a permit in these states. Tennessee is one of them. Texas is one of them. I believe Arizona. There's a number of states. So, but I think it's over 20 states now that now have constitution carry laws. And, you know, that's constitutional. Should be in all the states. But anyway, get back to our task at hand here. All right, so Article 4 reads now after that part, and the Congress may by general laws prescribe and manage in which such acts, records, and proceedings shall be proved and the effects thereof. So, for example, our driver's license. While the driver's license belongs to each state, Congress may make a basic template saying this is the way we want it to be proven that you can drive in that state with a driver's license with at least this basic information on it. So Congress can create law, you know, creating a standard of what they expect, even though each act or license or whatever it is, you know, goes with each state. Now, let's continue. Section 2, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. In other words, if you're a citizen of the United States, you are a citizen of the country, and so no matter where you go in the country, because of your citizenship, you are to be treated no different than any other citizen. And say, let's say I go to Texas, and I've got this California license with me, you know, and I drive into Texas, and Texas says, well, hey, you know, you're from California, so you're, you know, you have to abide by different laws here. The fine is higher for running that red light for Californians. No, that's not the way it's supposed to be. Citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. Your privileges and immunities are the same. So your license works in another state. The law is going to be applied to you in the same manner because you're a citizen of the United States. And so you're to be treated, and that's for all citizens. And notice it doesn't, you know, delineate here who or what, you know, male or female or anything like that. There's nothing in the Constitution. The word woman, the word women, the word man, the word men, and the word black or Hispanic or anything else is not in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't segregate. All persons, all Americans, all persons, the citizens, general, you know, the inhabitants, those types of general terms. The Constitution does not segregate, it integrates. We're all citizens. We're all Americans under this umbrella of the United States. Now, at one point, there were some people that resided in the state that weren't considered citizens, slaves. That was rectified. That's a nice thing about, living and growing and all that is over time, things that may not be completely right are corrected. They are moving in the right direction. But anyway, so there you go. That's that part of the Constitution, the next part. Now we've got a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled be delivered up and removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. The executive authority of the state being the governor. So we have extradition laws, basically. Once again, now we are a country. Now the states are a part of a union. So you can't flee to some other state. It's funny because remember that show, Dukes of Hazzard? And they try to get to the county line. Once we get to the county line, they don't have jurisdiction and we're safe. Well, it doesn't work that way. The law follows you. The radio's faster than your car, and they'll just hand it off to the sheriff of the next county or the state police of the next state or whatever. You know, no matter what, your whatever follows you. So if you're charged with a crime or anything like that and you escape, and, you know, let's say the California governor says, hey, this person needs to be tried here in California. Arizona, we found out that he's there. Extradite him back to California. And Arizona will do that. They can do that. So once again, this whole section regarding the states in Article 4 is just explaining we're a country now. You know, you were 13 individual colonies, then you became 13 states with the original authorities over everything. But now, under the Constitution, you're coming together into a union and you're uniting under a federal government that's going to handle all the external issues. And since we're under this one system and we are under one union and so on and so forth, you all are going to play nice. You're going to get along with each other. You're going to share information. You're going to allow people from other states to be treated no differently than your own citizens and so on and so forth. That's really what Article 4 is all about. Now, remember earlier I mentioned slavery. The word slave or slavery is not in the Constitution, or at least not until the amendments that are tied to the Reconstruction period. But the founders, when they wrote the Constitution, they recognized that slavery was a local issue. It's up to each state. And that the states had their own laws. And that, once again, we wanted all the states to sign the Constitution. So it wasn't a pro-slavery thing or anything like that. It's just recognizing that it existed. And that the federal government and the Constitution could not outlaw it inside the United States. That had to be each state to do it individually on its own. Now, that said, the external stuff, if you remember back when we were in Article 1, Section 9, the Atlantic slave trade, that could be outlawed by the federal government, and they did in 1808. But when it came to the laws within the states regarding slavery, that's up to the states. The states have their own localism. If you remember going back to when I was first talking about the Founding Fathers, the Constitution, all that, there's this idea of localism. Local issues for local government, external issues for the federal government. So the federal government handles federal issues. The state handles state issues. The county handles county issues. And the cities handle city issues. You know, you need a new stoplight in town. You don't call up some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. saying, hey, can we have a light here? It's none of their business. Localism. Local government takes care of local issues, local problems, so on and so forth. And slavery was considered a state issue, a local deal, and that each locality then would have to make their own decisions on it. Did the Founding Fathers largely wish that slavery was abolished? Absolutely. In fact, they expected it to be abolished within their lifetime, but it wasn't. But nonetheless, compromise. Want to make sure that all the states are willing to sign this Constitution, they made some compromises, and one of the compromises is this next passage. And this is the passage that the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was based on. But here's, and you'll notice if you have your Constitution in front of you, that this passage is in brackets. And the brackets simply mean that it's obsolete, it's no longer in play. But anyway, so this is what's in the brackets. Changed by the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery. But this is how it was worded. No person, so once again, we're using the word person. We don't want to demean those who are enslaved as being anything other than people. They're still people. So they're using the word person, not slave, not those enslaved. No person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered upon claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. And that was really the kind of the fuel behind the Dred Scott decision. If you've heard about the Dred Scott case, Dred Scott was a slave that worked for a medical an individual in the medicine. This doctor, they had traveled to a different state together. And Dred Scott basically said, now I'm in a free state, and because I'm in a free state, I am free. And the courts said, no, that's not true. You're still under your service or labor, under the person who has got that contract over you. And whether you're here with him or you escape, the fact is, you still belong to that person. You still belong under that contract, and that needs to be abided by. And then it said, then they said something interesting in the Dred Scott case, which is very interesting to me, that anyone who has been held under enslavement or whatever can't have citizenship. Well, that was really a blow, and that ticked off a lot of people. That was basically saying that, you know, some of these black folks, these African Americans, if you want to call that word now, I'm not fond of it. I don't like hyphenated words. We're all Americans, but that's beside the point. But any black that escaped slavery into a free state, basically Dred Scott was saying, you used to be a slave, so you still can't be a citizen. You may be in reach your freedom, but you get no citizenship because you used to be a slave at one point, so you're just not entitled. This really angered people. It created a spark that started getting the abolition movement moving even faster. Dred Scott was a case that really angered people. But anyway, this clause that we just read also, like I said, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was written based on this clause. And you got to think about the time period now. So from the southern states' point of view, not that I'm condoning anything, I'm just telling you the mindset at the time. The southern states, they have this Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, federal law. They have this clause in Article 4, Section 2, saying, hey, if a slave escapes, they are to be extradited back to the person that their labor is due to, or their enslavement, or whatever you want to call it. And here we've got the northern states refusing to abide by that. If a slave escapes into the north, they're protecting them, kind of like a sanctuary state situation now with illegal aliens, right? Same kind of deal. And the southern states are saying, you know, that's unconstitutional. And so we have states in the north not following the Constitution. We have a federal government refusing to enforce the Constitution in these situations. And now, in 1860, we've got this dude named Abraham Lincoln, who's claiming he wants to contain slavery, and he's a part of a party that was established for the purpose of abolishing slavery. And on top of that, the Missouri Compromise now is no longer, well, it's been compromised. It's no longer in force because the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And so now, you know, free states are being added without slave states corresponding. So in the House of Representatives now, the slave states are being outnumbered. We see the writing on the wall. We're out of here. We're seceding. And that's what happened. Abraham Lincoln was elected, and between the time he was elected and he was inaugurated, that's when all those states seceded. They left the Union. So the country, the America that Abraham Lincoln was elected to was different than the one that he was inaugurated to, because those states were gone. They seceded. They left the Union. Their attitude was, the contract is being breached. We're out of here. We're going to create our own country. And then they wrote their own constitution that's largely based on the U.S. Constitution, with a lot of Articles of Confederation information in it. They didn't include ideas like all men are created equal, because they didn't believe that the black man was created equal to the white man. Matter of fact, in his cornerstone speech, the Vice President Stevens of the Confederate States of America said that. Says, hey, unlike Jefferson, who wrote all men are created equal, and he believed that those who were enslaved were also equal, we don't believe that, said Stevens in the Cornerstone speech. We don't believe that. We believe that the two races can never get along, one subservient to the other, so on and so forth. And so that was it. What's interesting about that Cornerstone speech is Stevens did admit that when Jefferson wrote all men are created equal, he meant everyone, including those enslaved. And Stevens basically says, but we don't believe that. And so the southern states, the Confederate states, they seceded. They created their own country. We're out of here. The Constitution is being breached, was their attitude. And so Abraham Lincoln becomes president. He gets inaugurated, and he was taught under the tutelage of a law system that was based on the beliefs of John Marshall. And John Marshall didn't believe it was a voluntary union. He believed that the United States is a firm union. And so the southern states couldn't legally secede, and therefore they needed to be brought back in. The union needed to be held together, and we needed to remain united. And so to hold together the union, force must be used. And so Lincoln did. Folks from the South might call the war between the states the War of Northern Aggression, because the Union decided that military aggression and military occupation was the way to hold together the Union. And the South's attitude was, hey, you know, this is a voluntary union. We have the right to leave. We have a right not to be a part of it. And so you get these two opinions going up against each other, and you know, goes from there. So, well, when we get to the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, I'll get more into it. But I just wanted to let you know that that was a big deal. That was an important part of all that. All right, now I'm going to get into Section 3 in a minute. But first, I want to take a quick break. And after the break, we'll go through Article 4, Section 3 and Article 4, Section 4. So hang tight. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Creator by Douglas V. Gibbs is on sale now. His eighth book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses seven critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation and cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' beliefs in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the Republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Hey, do you know about the USA? Do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution? Hey, learn about the USA.
The Constitution is the instruction booklet for taking back the country. Douglas V. Gibbs.
1787, I'm told our founding fathers did agree to write a list of principles for keeping people free. The USA.
The Constitution Association's website is at constitutionassociation.com. Constitution Association believes that the Constitution is the solution and the real hope for America. Be a hero in America's story. Make a difference. Protect, preserve, promote, restore the Constitution. Reclaim the Republic. Make America constitutional again. constitutionassociation.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Thank you for listening to the program, and let me remind you that once again, as I stated earlier in the show, that each week this program comes to you because of funding from folks like you. If you want to help keep this program on the air, please feel free to contribute to the effort. It could take $10 a month, $20 a month, or a large gift at one time, however you want to do it. But the program, in order to stay on the air, requires help from the listeners. I do not have advertisers. I do not have sponsors. I conduct Constitution classes throughout Southern California, six classes within. And with gas prices going sky high, that's getting hard to even have enough money left over for the program. But so the program really requires you. DouglasVGibbs.com. PoliticalPistachio.com, DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com. Hit the donate link.
We are the socialists. You will be assimilated. Your individual liberties, personal freedoms, and mental individuality will be added to our own. Resistance is futile.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled. You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZ. San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, welcome back. I am Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. This is the Mr. Constitution Hour on KPRZ, 1210 AM, 106.1 FM in San Diego County, and online at kprz.com, iHeartRadio, Odyssey, Alexa, Spotify, and even our own webpage where we keep the podcast. You can go to douglasvgibbs.com and find the radio link for this show, and you can find the link to the podcast there as well. Anyway, so glad you're with us. Glad you're listening. We're going to continue through Article 4 here now. So Article 4, Section 3. Now, this is important. This is something that has interesting stories tied into it. Article 4, Section 3, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union. So first of all, who determines who's going to come in is Congress. Congress is the determining factor. They're the ones that vote for if a territory or whoever becomes a state. So, you know, there was word about Washington, D.C. or Puerto Rico. Well, it's up to Congress to decide. Now, in the case of Washington, D.C., the part that is a district, the 10-square-mile district, cannot become a state without a constitutional amendment, because that particular district was established as a district by the Constitution. But that area around it, the city, if they wanted to turn that into state, they could. I don't think it's a good idea. It's federal land. They have, people say, well, no taxation without representation. They have representation, the Electoral College. They get electoral votes, and also they do have representatives that attend Congress, the House and the Senate. They just don't have a vote because they're not a state. In the case of Puerto Rico really isn't going to become a state unless they want to. While Congress can make them a state, technically, or, well, typically, I should say, Congress waits to make sure that the territory or whoever it is wants to be a state. Now, at one time, Mexican-American War, the Yucatan Peninsula actually sent delegates to Washington, D.C. to ask to become a state. And there was a number of reasons why not, and part of it was the Missouri Compromise. Any territory south of the southern border of Missouri, according to the Missouri Compromise, needed to come in as a slave state, and Yucatan said, no, we want to be a free state, and so the slave states voted down their application there in Congress. But think about that. Yucatan Peninsula almost became a state. And there were also other parts of Mexico that wanted to become states, Rio Grande and so on and so forth. Because Santa Ana had pretty much ripped up, stomped all over, and destroyed the 1824 Constitution of Mexico, which was based on ours. It was written with ours as its model. And so whenever you see flags in images, or not images, but paintings of the Mexican-American War, or of the strife that was going on under Santa Anna with all of the war stuff going on, and you see these flags with the Mexican colors, but they have 1824 on the flag, that represents the Mexican Constitution, which was based on America's Constitution. That was the reason why Mexico even became a federal government and created states the whole bit. They're trying to be like us. Santa Anna ruined that, and so rather than being prosperous and free like the United States, Mexico has had their issues, and it's because of the system. It's not because of resources, it's not because of race or background, it's because of the system in place, and the system is not what America's is, and so it doesn't prosper in the same way. Anyway, okay, so there's also another example of a state become a state that's interesting. The new states may be admitted to the by Congress into this union, it says, but no state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of the Congress. So, in the case of forming a new state from other states, it's more than just Congress. For example, there's this idea for the state of Jefferson. There's a bunch of counties in Southern Oregon and Northern California that would like to secede from their liberal states and their hardcore progressive states, California and Oregon, and form their own state of Jefferson. In order to do that, they would not only need to get permission from Congress to do it, but also from the state legislatures of the states involved. Because Oregon's going to lose some counties, California's going to lose some counties to form this new state. So Sacramento and Salem, the two capitals of the two states, would need to then approve it. If they don't approve it, can't happen. Now, there is an exception to that one, West Virginia. Well, see, West Virginia, the situation was a little different. Virginia had seceded, and the counties in what became West Virginia, it's like, we're against secession. We want to be part of the Union. So they seceded from Virginia. They applied to the Union as a slave state, interestingly enough, and the Union, the Congress, accepted them as a state, and they became the state of West Virginia. The permission did not need to be obtained from the state of Virginia, because Virginia was no longer under the Constitution. They had seceded. So the requirement, the constitutional requirement, no longer applied. They were outside the Constitution. They had seceded. They had left the contract. So there you go. All right, let's continue. The Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. So if it's not a state, it's a territory, or it's a district, or it's a military base, or whatever, it's owned by the, it's basically run by Congress. Congress makes the rules. Congress makes the decisions. And until the Act of 1871, which incorporated Washington, D.C. into a city, Congress even made all the rules for Washington, D.C. But now they have a mayor and a local government. That was the purpose of incorporating Washington, D.C. into a city in 1871. You know, Puerto Rico. While they have a governor, they have local governance and all that. Ultimately, the job of their rules and regulations all is up to Congress. Congress is the administrative and legislative arm of that territory. Same thing with Guam, America, Samoa, and so on and so forth. That's how it works. So Congress shall have power to dispose and make of all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and nothing in this Constitution shall be construed as to prejudice any claims of the United States or of any particular state. So in other words, just because the Constitution is saying that Congress has authority over this, you know, the territories that are with the federal government, well, if a state has a claim, federal government, it doesn't say, oh, well, that's federal government too. No. If a state has a claim over land and that's their territory, the Constitution is not saying, oh, the United States also, that territory is under the federal government. No, states can actually have their own territories that are outside their, they're not necessarily within their state, but it's a territory, but they have jurisdiction over it. Realm of, the sphere of influence, I think would be another word for it. You know, unincorporated cities are like that. You know, it's like when I first moved to the city I'm in right now, I lived in an unincorporated area. We didn't get annexed until like 2001. But even though we were in an unincorporated area, we belonged to the county, we still, in our address, had the name of the city that we had the sphere of influence over. So while we weren't technically a part of the city, our address showed that we were under their sphere of influence. And that's what territories can be under the state's sphere of influence. All right. Now, Article 4, Section 4. This is important. This is interesting because it gets into a topic that I talk about a lot that folks don't seem to understand. You'll hear me say things all the time about republic versus democracy. We're not a democracy, we are a republic. And I've been told that that's racist, that's horrible, that's wrong. It's got a sinister motive behind it, that states' rights are racist, and you know, so on and so forth. And that's just not true. So Article 4, Section 4 says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a republican form of government. What's the difference between a democratic form of government and a republican form of government? A democratic form of government means that every part of government is directly influenced by the vote of the people. Now, in our case, there is representation, and the representatives you know, are not necessarily the people voting for something, but they are still supposed to directly represent the people. So we're not supposed to be democracy, we're supposed to be a republic. Well, what does that mean? What is the difference between a republic and a democracy? Well, in a republic, there are other mechanisms in place. There are other constituencies. There's other things going on. For example, in the United States, originally, the only political body that was voted into office by the people was the House of Representatives. President voted in by the electors that were appointed by the state legislatures. United States Senate, senators are voted in by the state legislatures. You know, all the judges are nominated and then approved by the Senate. Confirmation. And so on and so forth. So the only part of the federal government that the people directly voted for was the House of Representatives. Now at the state level, the governor and the assembly and or what you call the state House of Representatives, that's voted in by the people. But guess what? The state Senate was not. The members of the state Senate were appointed by the county legislature, which was actually bicameral, just like our legislatures in our states, well, except for Nebraska anyway, and our Congress, bicameral. So was the county. And the state senators were not based on, it was not based on population, it was one per county. You know, they got the U.S. Senate, it's two per state, right? Well, the state senator was one per county. It wasn't by population. They were being appointed by the county leadership. That's a part of what makes the different states a republic. But Reynolds v. Sims in 1964, Alabama was sued for doing it in that manner, appointing their state senators, and the Warren Court said, well, it's not very democratic. Well, then by forcing Alabama to now have the state senators voted in by the people based on districts that are designed and gerrymandered based on population, the federal government, the Warren Court, they violated this clause. United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a republican form of government. Warren Court said, no, you need a democratic form of government. It needs to be a democracy. Violation of Article 4, Section 4, right there. These democratic mechanisms going beyond what was originally in place is a part of what's destroying us. We need to get back to being a Republican form of government. A republic. A republic has these mechanisms in place so that, the people don't have all the voice. We don't want any one group to have too much power. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. You don't want absolute power belonging to the people in a democracy. Just like you don't want the president to have all the power, or the Congress to have all the power, or the judges to have all the power. You don't want the people to have all the power. We'll mess it up too. So there's a distribution of power through the Constitution. Some of it goes in this direction, some of it goes in that direction. And the people's power was through the House of Representatives, their state assembly, their vote for governor. And then, of course, local government. The closer government gets to the people, the more democratic it becomes. Okay? So there you go. So the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion. All right, protect them against invasion against by who? Who are we talking about? Who's the invader? Well, any country that tries to invade the United States, right? So the United States needs to defend the states from invaders. But here's a question. Are people crossing the border without permission, without going through the immigration process, in other words, illegal aliens, is that an invasion? Well, if you look up the word invasion in the dictionary, it says an unwanted encroachment. So now we have to ask, are illegal aliens, are they committing, an act that makes them an unwanted encroachment? Absolutely. So it is an invasion. And so the federal government has every authority to do everything they can to stop that invasion, because they shall protect each of the states against invasion. It says so in Article 4, Section 4 of the United States Constitution. So now here's the question. Is the federal government protecting the states? No. You got a catch and release thing going on right now with the Border Patrol and so on and so forth. So we have a federal government that's falling down on the job. So they have to guarantee every state a Republican form of government, violated, and protect each of them against invasion. Violate. They're not doing their job. Then it says, and on application of the legislature or of the executive when the legislature cannot be convened against domestic violence. The legislature being your state legislature, the executive being the governor. So if the legislature says, you know what, we got some big time violence going on here in Portland or Seattle or whatever. Federal government, we need your help. But they have to ask for it. Federal government just can't come in with troops without them asking. And they don't. They didn't. Right? So we have a situation now where the federal government's like, well, we want to be involved here. We want to help because this looks like an insurrection going on in Seattle and Portland. So what they did is they sent federal agents and troops and all that to federal buildings to at least protect federal property, because the local government was refusing to ask the federal government for assistance because they didn't want to be protected against the domestic violence. They were for it. They supported it. Because for some reason they thought it would bring about, well, change. Now, I had mentioned borders earlier, and when I was talking about borders and illegal aliens and all that, you know, the Bible has 40 verses about borders from 15 different books in the Bible. And, I mean, when the Israelites were brought out of Egypt and they went into upon the borders of Canaan and so on and so forth, they went beyond the borders of Egypt. Borders existed and borders were important, and when God gave them their land, there were borders of that land as well for, lands given to Israel. And, it's funny because Thomas Jefferson, he has a quote that says that a country without borders is not a country. Borders is what makes a country a country, what gives a land its edges, its realm. And so borders, like I said, there's 40 verses about borders from 15 books in the Bible. Now, that all said, I want to remind everybody that when it comes to, the United States Constitution, that I'm a firm believer that the whole Constitution, that God is throughout this document, all of it. And that, when I talk about different parts of the Constitution, I've got a pastor, Pastor Stan Wojcik, from the Baptist Church, Emmanuel Baptist Church in Fallbrook. He will attend my classes, and sometimes he'll raise his hand, and it's amazing because of how often he can find verses that coincide with what the founders wanted, what they did. It's an amazing thing when you compare the Bible to the Constitution. And let us not forget that Christianity also is the foundation of this country. I know there's a prevailing attitude out there that slavery was the foundation, and that's not true. And matter of fact, I'm working on a book right now that I'm challenging the 1619 Project and all of that directly. But let me read you this. This is an excerpt from a book by J. Vernon Jacobs, titled 500 Little Known Stories from American History, published in 1964, just to give you an idea of, the early Christian foundations of our country. 1607 is when Jamestown was founded. So it says, when the first colonists landed in Jamestown in 1607, they conducted services in a rotten old tent. When they stretched an awning between the trunks of trees, nailing a bar between two of these to serve as a reading desk, the religious and courageous divine, Mr. Hunt, read the service morning and evening, preached twice every Sunday, and celebrated the Holy Communion at intervals of 3 months. Later, they constructed a church building made of logs and covered with rafts, sedge, and dirt. By 1610, they had a building 60 feet long and 24 feet broad, the first religious edifice erected by Englishmen in America. So even early on, the church was there. Christianity was established early on. And we can go into, talking about also, the Mayflower Compact and the Pilgrims as well. And in and we have to remember that in 1787, when the Constitutional Convention had convened in Philadelphia's Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence had been debated in 1776, that it was after like 4 or 5 weeks of debate, little progress had been made, and it was Benjamin Franklin that recommended to the delegation that they pray before each session. Divine Providence was the centerpiece of the view of the founders. Through Divine Providence, the English colonies defeated the most powerful military force in the world, and through Divine Providence, the greatest constitution in history was written after about 4 months of grueling debate. Benjamin Franklin, likely the least religious of the delegates there at the Constitutional Convention, he recognized God's hand in the forging of America. He was not afraid to voice his opinion on the matter after the first few weeks of debate during the Federal Convention of 1787, when it was yielding little way by way of results. The new country needed solutions, and the men present were arguing over matters that would not matter if the Union of States collapsed. The elder statesman, Benjamin Franklin, who had been watching the tumultuous beginnings of the convention with patience and in silence, spoke up. "Gentlemen, we are missing something." Franklin understood that if the convention was going to be able to move forward, the battling delegates had to discover a common bond that was both inspirational and demanded virtuous action. He recanted how they had been on their knees in prayer during the war against Britain. He reminded the delegates how all odds had been against the states that had united for war in the hopes of defeating the mightiest war power on earth. Yet with the hand of divine providence guiding them and protecting them, the newly formed Union of States defeated the British and now stood at the gateway of an exceptional existence. Had the delegates forgotten to place the current proceedings of Independence Hall in Philadelphia, the hands of God? The 81-year-old in round-rimmed glasses recounted all of the miracles of America and explained to the room of delegates that their bickering and disagreements simply prove that human understanding is imperfect. He commented on how they had studied history for examples of good and bad government, including the different forms of republics. He discussed with all of the laborious research that they had engaged in, and looking at the current systems of government throughout Europe, that no system studied was perfectly suitable for the needs of the fledgling United States. Even with all of that research in the convention, they could not seem to be able to find the political truth they sought. How is it that they could not find the answer? Could it be that something was missing? Should they, perhaps, humbly appeal to the Creator? Should they not consult the Father of Lights to illuminate their understanding? The American Revolution was a dangerous undertaking. The founders, Franklin reminded the delegates on an earlier occasion, during the war, were on their knees in daily prayer. The prayers were heard, and for only his favor could account for their victory. Franklin said that they were consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And have we now forgotten our powerful friend, or do you imagine that we no longer need his assistance? Benjamin Franklin was not known to be a religious man. He admitted that in his younger years he did not give much thought to the credence of the existence of God. But as he had grown older, his observations were telling him otherwise. To explain this, Franklin said, "I have lived, sir, a long time. The longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? Without God," he assured his fellow delegates, "we labor in vain. Without God, the government formed by the convention would fail. Without God, they would be divided, bickering over little partial local interests. Without God, the greatness that could be the United States would be lost to future generations. Benjamin Franklin, the celebrated deist by those who seek to deconstruct the story of the founding of the United States, then recommended that the delegates pray before each session of the convention. And that's a story I love to tell because it really shows not only the power of prayer, because you'll notice that before they began to pray, they couldn't get anything done. But after they finally came together to pray, the miracle happened. So now that prayer, you know, what happened, you know, after Benjamin Franklin had recommended that they pray, is there was a debate over whether or not they should pray. Alexander Hamilton led the opposition, said, hey, we don't need any foreign aid. And so the ones that wanted to pray, they went down the street to the nearest church, which was a Reformed Calvinist church. And they asked a pastor, William Rogers, an American clergyman, who led the Constitutional Convention in prayer, July 4th, 1787, at the Reformed Calvinistic Church of Philadelphia. And Rogers was a Baptist pastor that they trusted because he had served as a chaplain in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. He had left the church during the war to serve in the war. But anyway, this is the prayer. I want you to listen carefully to the prayer that he gave because it was, well, quite insightful, to be honest. And here it is. As this is a period, O Lord, big with events, impenetrable by any human scrutiny, we fervently recommend to thy fatherly notice that august body assembled in this city, who compose our federal convention. Will it please thee, O eternal I am, to favor them from day to day with thy immediate presence? Be thou their wisdom and their strength. Enable them to devise such measures as may prove happily instrumental for healing all divisions and promoting the good of the great whole. Incline the hearts of all the people to receive with pleasure, combined with a determination to carry into execution whatever these thy servants may wisely recommend, that the United States of America may furnish the world with one example of a free and permanent government, which shall be the result of human and mutual deliberation, and which shall not, like all other governments, whether ancient or modern, spring out of mere chance or be established by force. May we triumph in the cheering prospect of being completely delivered from anarchy and continue under the influence of republican virtue to partake of all the blessings of cultivated and civilized society. That's from the 4th of July, 1787 prayer for the Constitutional Convention by Reverend William Rogers. Now, the inclusion of prayer before the opening of each session of both the House and the Senate continues to this day. There are chaplains of the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. To this day, the history can be traced back to the colonial period. Colonial assemblies regularly had chaplains who would open proceedings with prayer. And the Second Continental Congress, after a request from Samuel Adams, did the same. And as I just mentioned, during the Constitutional Convention, about a month after the Constitutional Convention had begun in 1787, Dr. Benjamin Franklin had proposed that the sessions begin with a prayer. And after a few days of spirited debate, as I told you, it was about 4 days, some members proceeded to a nearby church to pray. Following Franklin's recommendation, in 1789, a chaplain's prayers opened Congress for both the House and the Senate. Next week, we'll get into Article 5. So until then, you have a great week. God bless you. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America. God bless you. Thank you for listening to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on KPRZE, San Diego County's Christian station. And Mr. Constitution Hour is your show around the country. Thank you for listening. DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye now.
General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.